From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues each week from a more holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit, not just dealing with what's going on mentally and psychologically, but what's going on within the body and the soul, spirit, however you want to call it. And that's what we do each week. This is a live call-in show. And if you're in the Phoenix area, the number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And if you're listening via the Internet on our live simulcast, it's also a toll call for you if you're calling from outside the Phoenix area, and the number is still the same, 480-949-1310. So those of you that are listening right now, I'm going to slowly go into what today's topic is about. Because for some of you, if I say that today's show is about sex, you're going to be staying tuned. Some of you may turn off because you find that topic uncomfortable or offensive. If I say to you that today's show is about seniors and sex, some of you may be intrigued. Some of you may say, I don't want to think about my parents and grandparents in that way. So you may tune out. If I say today is a special in acknowledging that Wednesday, December 1st, was World AIDS Day, then some of you will say, well, that doesn't concern me. I'm not gay. I don't shoot drugs. Or I just don't want to hear any more about AIDS. I'm tired of hearing about this. The epidemic is over, and this is too uncomfortable. I just don't want to hear another show. Okay? Those are the people that really need to listen to the show. Because today I'm talking about women and HIV. Now, one thing that we all need to acknowledge is that as this epidemic worldwide goes into over 20 years, that the stories of women are not often told, despite the fact that recent statistics show that 40% of all new infections in the U.S. are women and teenage girls, and they are at tremendous risk for infection and do not know it. And it is one of the stories that is not told. Now, if you keep looking at the statistics, it will go on to say that the people most at risk, women most at risk, are African American and Latinas. But the population of women that is seldom talked about, and most people don't think they're at risk, even within that group, are senior women, adult women, women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, who are still sexually active. And, you know, just because you think someone is in their 50s, 60s, 70s, or even 80s or 90s, don't think that the sex charge is turned off. There are still people, there are still human beings that desire intimacy and sexual contact, and it is happening, and it's something that needs to be addressed. So today, if you haven't, obviously, you won't be listening if I say this, if you've already turned off because of the topics that I mentioned, if you're still tuning in, you have actually a very eye-opening treat in terms of my guest today. Now, my guest is somebody that has been on the show twice before. And if you know my show and you know my website, tellthetruthfaster.com, you know that I archive every show that I've done for the last 3 years. And for some reason, the two shows I've done with Beverly London's, the studio each time somehow didn't get the recording. So today is the third time is a charm, we are hoping. My guest today is somebody that I've known for a couple of years, and she's been a client of mine, and she's okay with me saying that because she talks openly about it. And her name is Beverly London. And Beverly is a woman who is 68 years old, a mother, and a grandmother of 8, with the 9th grandchild due any day, as I understand it. And Beverly has written a book, which is still in manuscript form, so if anyone out there really likes what they're hearing and knows of a publisher to turn her on to, I really support that. But Beverly has been HIV positive since 1989, and her husband passed away from this, I think, in 1992. Before I even introduce Beverly, I want to read something from the book that she's written. And this is, the name of the book is Dirty Woman, Being HIV in a Crowded Room. And the quote to open the show goes like this, quote, "The story you are about to read, my story, is about the shame of being HIV positive in a crowded room, the misery of the diagnosis, losing my husband, the prescription drugs that nearly killed me, the miraculous macrobiotic cure that suddenly stopped working, the homeopathic that never worked, the deep compassion of the gay community where I found solace, and the kindness of family and friends who got me through the worst time. The real theme of this book, however, is secrets, the tragedy of keeping them, and the restorative powers of finally giving them up. I finally discovered that when we find the courage to shed our layers of shame and guilt, there is a whole, healthy human being hiding beneath, waiting to rise up and state her truth for all the world to see, for better or worse." Very powerful words, and very close to the themes of what Telling the Truth Faster is all about. So without waiting any longer, I want to introduce all of you to Beverly London. Beverly, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I know that your life has taken many twists and turns, but I want to start by asking you about secrets, about what you learned about secrets, and even the early history of finding out that your husband had AIDS and what went on with you and Perry at that early stage.
Right. I discovered his diagnosis in 1988, and at that time I was testing negative. He was horribly frightened. He was a professor at Harvard University. He was afraid of what his colleagues would say. Back then there was a lot of homophobia, a lot of fear about the HIV being possibly contagious through casual contact with people, and unbeknownst to me, he also had a gay lover that I didn't know about, and I'm sure that was his worst secret that I didn't find out about until after his death. But he swore me to secrecy. A few months after he was diagnosed and we were lying to people about him, I tested positive, and then I got sucked into having secrets of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so frightened of the whole business that it took me 11 years to tell my own children that I was HIV positive, even though I eventually told them about their stepfather, and they came and they helped me take care of Perry during the last stages of his illness. They thought I was HIV negative. They believed my lies. And once you tell a lie, you are stuck with it. Someone has said that unlike a cat who has 9 lives, a lie has many lives. It goes well beyond 9. You have to tell one lie to cover up another lie. Soon you can't remember what you've told the people, and you're not only ashamed of being HIV positive, you're ashamed of having lied.
Mm-hmm.
So So it just became this endless deep well of lies that I had told people.
And how did that impact you physically? I mean, how aware were you of the physical manifestations of holding all this stuff inside?
I was pretty much in denial. Mm-hmm. What it did was hold me back as far as my lifestyle was concerned, because I didn't go out, I didn't date, I didn't put myself into a situation where I could let people get to know me. When I did finally start to come out, I could tell strangers. I could sit next to somebody on an airplane and tell them I was HIV positive, but I couldn't tell my next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly, I started telling people and started to realize that people didn't withdraw, and that those that did withdraw, it was okay. They weren't really my friends anyway. And it was very slow. I had therapy. I had a rabbi that I would speak to. Eventually, I told next-door neighbors. Everybody then was encouraging me to tell my children. But it took years. It took a lot of experimenting. And I don't know that it impacted my health, my physical health, but it certainly impacted my life and my lifestyle.
By isolating you.
By isolating me, right. I was isolated and cornered with my secrets.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I know about you, Beverly, is that you're a light. You're a vibrant person. You're an intelligent person. You have a great sense of humor. You have a passion for life and relationships and a passion for having passion. And I can remember you telling me very often about what it feels like not to be able to live in that passionate energy and repressing one's aliveness led to, again, your isolation, your loneliness, a great deal of depression, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And what else emotionally was going on because of keeping the secrets and the fear and the shame?
Right.
You know, I know that there were times when you were talking to me about not even wanting to live.
Oh, right, mm-hmm. Right. And even that was a secret. Because outwardly, my life looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Socially, I get along well with people. I was teaching, so I was surrounded by my students. I was seeing my children and my grandchildren, and ostensibly, I lived a pretty good life. I didn't have any financial concerns. I could travel when I wanted. What I wasn't saying was that I went home every night to an empty apartment, that the most important thing about my life, my health, was something that I didn't talk about with people. And so people were just seeing the tip of the iceberg that looked so appealing. And inside of me, I mean, I'd be in a closed room with you, talking to you as my therapist, and I'd tell you how absolutely lonely I was and how my life was a lie and the smile on my face was artificial, and I would close the door to my apartment at night and just collapse in tears because I couldn't stand who I was. I was living the type of life that wasn't very valuable. I mean, the passion was all contrived.
And from what I remember, you were translating the HIV as now you aren't a valuable human being anymore.
Right.
Right. So it's right. Kind of like one thing fed into to another. And, you know, I mean, in this day and age, you know, 20 years into this epidemic, there is still that element of shame and guilt and struggle when people find out that they're HIV positive. And there's still, in a lot of communities, especially minority communities, where people have a genuine difficult time dissociating their HIV status from their self-worth.
Yeah, you really want to go stick your head in a hole.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange because cognitively, you know, I knew I had gotten it from my husband. I hadn't been sexually promiscuous. I didn't do drugs. It was not my fault. I had done my life, everything, I'd done my life very well.
Mm-hmm. And you raised some great kids.
Right, but you still feel dirty. I think it's just a Judeo-Christian ethic that we grow up with,
mm-hmm.
that anything, if you have to say the word sex in the sentence, you don't say the sentence.
And there's another level to this also that a lot of people, like I said in my introduction, don't want to think about. You know, here you were in your 60s and wanting to talk about the lack of sex in your life and the lack of sexual and physical intimacy. And most people don't want to hear people in their 60s and 70s talking about sex. It's an image that most people don't want to conjure up. And that's very disrespectful for people who, as human beings, still have desires for intimacy, sexual and physical.
Right.
So it adds another level, and that's why your story, I think, takes this whole issue of HIV and AIDS to another level, because it's not just about the disease, it's about honoring people in middle age and our seniors who still are vibrant and alive, and people don't want to hear what their needs and desires are about. So what happens is, and this is why this is also an important story, seniors are dating, and seniors are still looking for love. My mother's 82 and has been with her boyfriend, is now 88, and they've been together for 4 years. They're living together. You know, the need for companionship, the need for physical intimacy, all that stuff is there. I don't care what the age is, and yet seniors are not educated enough to understand that they need to use condoms. They need to understand what it is to protect themselves. They think, well, there's no need to worry about pregnancy anymore. And, you know, it's like this guy's dating me, so why would I think he's out doing anything else with guys? It is an issue that seniors who are dating need to really take seriously. This is not just the worry that they should have for their grandchildren.
Right. I dated one man a few years ago who he was interested in me, and we knew one another for a period of time, and we got to the point where possibly the relationship was going to become sexual. And I told him I was HIV positive, and he turned to stone. And I thought, well, you know, he's angry with me. And he became so frightened, not because of me, but because he said to me, it never occurred to me that I could have sex with somebody who was HIV positive, or that somebody would lie to me, or that somebody maybe wouldn't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And we became friends. We never did become lovers. But he would talk about this phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
of feeling so totally safe and looking at me. You know, I was in my 60s,
mm-hmm.
and I looked so presentable. I was
presentable, you're beautiful, you're a gorgeous woman.
But, you know, this white Caucasian,
uh-huh.
educated teacher, grandchildren and children, and never done anything tacky in my whole life, and I could be HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very grateful to me, but it certainly changed his outlook on who he felt he could have sex with,
mm-hmm.
and the discussion that had to go on beforehand.
And that's the gift you gave him, is that any time he's getting involved with anyone else,
absolutely.
That is something discussed. And that, again, you know, we talk about how do we teach our teenagers and young adults and college-age students to negotiate to keep themselves safe before having sex, or to choose not to have sex, or to use condoms if they are going to do it. And, you know, most of the parents and teachers are so uncomfortable talking about this topic that how can they be expected to teach these young people about
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Now
mm-hmm.
you take the parents and the grandparents who have never really been used to discussing these things,
mm-hmm.
never thought they had to. Now all of a sudden, because of maybe being widowed or divorced, they find themselves back in the dating pool, and
mm-hmm.
they're more at a loss of how to negotiate these things or even think that they have to than their teenage grandkids or college-age grandkids.
Right. My experience is that they don't even think they have to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it never crosses their mind
mm-hmm.
that could become a problem for any of their peers.
And yet there is an increasing number. Now, I talked earlier about the Latina and the African-American women, the numbers that are skyrocketing, the number of teenagers in that group that are skyrocketing and nobody wants to deal with other than teaching abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sizable number of people that fit your demographic, which is the white, middle, and upper-class woman, very educated, successful in many ways. But, again, how many of those women do you know? Because aren't they, they're just dealing with the shame the same way you did. So my experience of what you had to deal with was that you had to actually turn to the gay community for most of your support at the beginning.
All of it, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was years, it was decades before I met white women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've never really met anyone quite in my demographic that has admitted to it.
Right.
So I think there's probably other women like me out there that just keep it a secret.
They're very closeted about it.
Right. I was shocked when I finally did meet white women and got into a group of women. All of them were having unprotected sex, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually left the group because it was just so uncomfortable for me.
What was their rationale?
Their partners agreed to it.
Okay.
It's doctors even have said to me, oh, it's practically impossible for a man to get it from you. You know, you don't have to worry. That's just not acceptable to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so these were women that were in monogamous relationships with either their husbands or their boyfriends, and the men did not use protection,
mm-hmm.
And the women went along with it.
Right. But you see, that's a common thing, even for getting HIV. Usually the women feel so disempowered in terms of the sexual relationship that they don't feel that they have a right to negotiate this, or that if they don't do it the way the man wants to, that they won't have the intimacy and that he'll leave.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a really lack of self-empowerment among a lot of women, even in our society, in our culture, where women tend to fear being alone and fear that if they take care of their own needs, the man's going to leave.
Right, right.
And so, you know...
And there's a lot of macho among men thinking that they can pull it off.
Right.
You know, not going to happen to them.
I mean, I have a very close friend who's married, and he was diagnosed with AIDS. AIDS at a certain point, but we found out he was HIV positive a month before his wedding, and this is his second wife. And he had totally lost touch with his first wife, and he only about a year ago found out that she had passed away and that she had AIDS when she died.
Oh, dear.
This is clearly an example of, because she was actually very active sexually and very promiscuous and stuff. And this is a clear example that even though it's not as common, it can happen, and people need to be conscious that he couldn't figure out where he got it from, and turns out he got it from his ex-wife.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
I know. So... It is possible. Even if it is true that it's less likely, it still is possible, and people are taking risks when they allow that to happen.
And you shouldn't take a risk. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it. You can have very nice sex using protection.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, nobody wants to be HIV positive.
Why? because there's an increase in the gay community of new HIV infections because of, you know, partly it's just AIDS fatigue, like I was saying at the beginning of the show, oh, another show on AIDS, I don't want to hear this. Partly because it's the younger generation that didn't live through the horrors of, you know, like I've said on the show many times, during the peak in the late 80s through the mid-90s, you know, I mean, it was commonplace for me to be going to 2 or 3 memorial services a week and visit
right.
5 to 10 people in the hospital at a single time.
Right.
And the losses were immense. So part of it is burnout. Part of it is that a lot of these younger guys didn't live through that and don't understand the reality of what it can be. They don't see the Kaposi sarcoma walking down the street. They don't see people with wasting, with walkers walking down the street. So they think, well, there are medications now.
And right. The medications, I know they keep you alive and they keep me alive, but they're no great gift. First of all, they're extremely expensive.
Right.
You have to make certain you have good health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And they have side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they stop working, which they stop doing from time to time, you have to search for new ones. And there's a certain amount of anxiety there. Also, you have to have protected sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it impacts your life in many, many ways. That's not to say that you can't have a good life and be HIV positive, but you can have a better life without it. as you know.
This is very true.
And right. It's like any major illness. You don't want a life-threatening illness.
Right.
You know, you do just fine. I know a lot of people with diabetes and I know a lot of people with cancer and all the rest, and they do very well, but they would gladly give up the illness.
Mm-hmm.
And HIV is no different.
Well, this is very true. And that's why, to me, all of this is why your voice, and I've said this to you since I met you, your voice, being a minority within a minority within a minority, is so important because you're so eloquent. Your book is so important. Your story is so important. And your healing journey is so important to be told because the healing journey you've been on is relevant whether it's applied to HIV issues or whether it's applied to any life struggles that anybody's going through.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's the power of your book, you know, is that, yes, it may be in the context of your journey with HIV, but it really is in the context of your journey with secrets and lies and moving into your truth.
Mm-hmm.
So you've already talked about what it was like to finally start coming out, so to speak, to your family and friends and your kids, dealing with the investigative and detective work and realizing that, you know, what Perry had told you about it being from a prostitute was not the case. And then dealing with your own anger as well as shame called for something that most people would find unimaginable, which is you moving into a place of forgiveness.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about that part of the journey.
Okay. In the process of coming out, I spoke with some old friends who they had made me angry because after I told them I was HIV positive, I felt they responded in a not very warm fashion. And I had told them what I believed to be true, that Perry had gotten it from a prostitute and that I had been infected for a number of years and I had been lying to people about how he died and about my life now. And these people didn't respond in a very warm fashion. So I confronted them on that, and they had known that he had a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought I was lying to them about how Perry had gotten it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was news to me, that he was in a relationship with a man.
Mm-hmm.
This was years after my infection.
Right.
And just after I started coming out and being comfortable with who I was, all of a sudden the secret got a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because it not only now involved sex, it involved gay sex.
Right.
And that was a whole other issue that I had to deal with. And I had to deal with the knowledge that Perry knew that he was being exposed to AIDS and he was having sex with his boyfriend and that he was coming home and having unprotected sex with me. And that for years I lived with him in these circumstances and he never ever protected me.
And you had no reason to believe anything but the fact that it must have been a prostitute because your life with him was vibrant and passionate and fun. You talked about how much the two of you laughed together, how great the sex with each other was and stuff. You know, you really, from what I remember, had no reason to doubt that or question it.
Right. No. It never occurred to me mm-hmm. that he would lie to me.
Right.
It just never came up.
Mm-hmm.
But after I found out and I started to tell people and I started to live with the knowledge of how he had gotten it, for the first time I really understood his secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
I understood what his shame was.
Right.
And why it was so important to him that he not tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a man who had 40 jillion friends who died practically in isolation. No one knew he was sick. No one knew what he had. It was just me and my children, and we took care of this man, and he died. He died in shame and isolation. And so when I began to understand how ashamed he felt, it was much more than the shame that I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why he couldn't be honest with me or with himself. And slowly, 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 I started to forgive him.
Well, the amazing thing that I think people listening to this right now would go into is, who is this woman that can shift into such a space of compassion for this man who, quote-unquote, had done this to her?
Yeah, but you know, you're not given the option. The only option is for you to drop your anger, or else you're going to live in that place.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to always feel the victim. You're always going to think that someone's taken horrible advantage of you. And it's either learn how to forgive or live in a state of great anger.
And die.
And so I was able to do that. I had a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
I went to workshops. I started meditating. I started talking with you about it and others. My editor was very helpful because she was walking me through the experience and having me write about it. And I think everybody has guilty secrets. Nobody had a secret quite like his. I mean, his was a whopper.
Well,
not only
but the reality of it is a lot of people do have that secret, which is the sad part of our society, that the fear of how people are going to react is so ingrained in us that people
right.
live their lives in that secret.
Right.
I want to read another little paragraph here because it's relevant to this from your book, and it goes, "In the end, forgiveness is my supreme task towards family members who judged me harshly, people who hurt me along the way, and especially toward my ex-husband. I constantly remind myself that he had no lack of love for me, only a lack of courage to face the reality of his own life. Most of all, I need to forgive myself for buying into a lifestyle of secrets and fear that turned more than a decade of my life into a private hell. I have learned from the twists and turns of day-to-day existence that once we give up the bitterness in our hearts, our capacity for survival and love grows exponentially."
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying there is, not just what you've talked about in terms of getting to a place of forgiving him and the other people who knew and didn't tell you or warn you, but about self-forgiveness, too.
Mm-hmm.
How did that show itself, and how did you get into that?
I think it was a gradual process of if you hold on to not forgiving yourself, Then you're living in a place of self-pity. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a survival tactic just to let it go. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Keep talking about that because it's relevant. And again, not just in the context of HIV and this stuff. This is part of what Telling the Truth Faster is about, is what things do when we don't forgive ourselves, that bottom line.
Right. You drag it around mm-hmm. with you. And I often realize that Perry, look how he died. I mean, he was such a great guy, and he had such a horrible death, mm-hmm. psychologically and spiritually, being cut off from his family and his friends, and in the end from me. And he didn't know that people could forgive him. You know, he didn't mean to do anything wrong. He got trapped in his own life.
Right.
And because he couldn't face up to it, he had no idea that people could forgive him. And you know what? People forget about this stuff. When it's happening to you, it's like it's the whole world, and you think you can't possibly put it aside. But then you find out when you return to the world as a whole person that there's a whole world out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't live on this page.
Say
but
that
they
again.
Don't.
Say that again. That's an important thing.
I said people don't live on this page.
Right.
You know, there's a whole world out there, but you have to let go
right.
of the bad stuff. If you're just mired down in all that yucky stuff,
mm-hmm.
then that's where you're going to be living. And that you're never going to see the broad world around you.
Mm-hmm. Now, another quote that I have from you here is, love is the ingredient that gives my life purpose and zest, even as it did when Perry was alive. And then you go on to, in another page from your book, without a partner, I am in exile from a part of my sexuality that was cut off way too early and has lain dormant for far too long. I'm trying to put the pieces back together that I might draw in a great love, all the while knowing that I may never find it. But hope is here. I have a shot at it, and the puddle of love between my legs is a gift from God that puts a smile on my face. I love that line in your book. It is my birthright and heritage as a woman to love and be loved. And although I may not be a great beauty, great beauty shines through me at the possibility of love and sex and the gift of simply being alive. My hope for myself is that besides finding a partner, I might fall more deeply in love with the woman I have become. My hope for all of us is that we may find love, 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 and sex, 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 while we revel in joy and equanimity, celebrating the whole and truthful human being that exists within each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Your writing is incredible, and this book has to get published because, I mean, I told you I gave the manuscript to a woman who I've known for years, whose husband had AIDS and passed away within the last year.
Mm.
And she went into, I mean, they were open about it for a long time, and she stood by him, and their kids knew and all this other stuff. But she chose to isolate herself during that dying process when he was in dementia and everything else instead of reaching out to a lot of us. Now she's showing up again.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that your manuscript would be a great inspiration to her, and I know it has been. But
she's HIV negative?
She's negative.
Uh-huh.
Now, the beginning of that was, without a partner, I am in exile from a part of my sexuality that was cut off way too early and has lain dormant for far too long.
Right.
As this healing process went on and you were dealing with the loneliness and coming into a place of acceptance, what did you finally choose to do?
Actually, it was chosen for me in a way. I started meeting men that were HIV positive. That was the easiest group to meet. And nothing much came of that. And because I had come out to my intimate friends, and I started to talk about my loneliness, they got on my back about, well, do something about it, stop complaining. And I actually signed up for eHarmony, which
uh-huh.
is a matching service.
Yeah.
And I signed up for a year, and I was matched with many, many different men. But my profile is quite unusual, not just the HIV, but I love classical music. I love opera. I wanted somebody that was educated and interested in opera and the same type of things that I am. I also needed a partner who understood what family was, because I'm so ingrained with my family. So I didn't meet anybody for 5 months, even though I had been put in touch with people and many men had been interested in meeting me. And finally, this man popped up. He's a few years older than I. He's a widower. His family were a smattering of Christian and Jews, like mine. He had children and grandchildren, loved classical music, loved opera. I didn't know what he looked like. I had my picture posted, but he didn't. And I thought, I don't care if you have three noses. You know, you and I sound very much alike. And I met him in a restaurant for lunch, and we've been together ever since.
And your profile stated about your HIV status? Or
no.
No, it did not.
It did not. No.
And at what point, you know, I remember you talking to me about how excited you were about meeting this man, but at
right.
what point did the conversation, because I know that you have a level of integrity that you would not move past a certain point without him knowing that.
Right.
How did
right.
you handle that?
It was obvious that we, he told me on the first date he wasn't going to date anybody else. You know, this was after a two-hour lunch.
He knew he had found Mrs. Wright.
Right, right. And I, of course, said, no, you've got to go out with other people and all this, but he was firm. On the third date, I told him I was HIV positive, and he said initially that he couldn't understand how anyone could hurt me that much, but he was going to have to say goodbye because he didn't think he'd be able to handle it. He'd be frightened for himself and for his children and grandchildren. And, you know, we hadn't kissed or anything, but obviously there was a lot of chemistry there. And then he...
How did you feel when he said that to you?
I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally prepared for it. You know, that would certainly be his choice, and that was fine. But we talked for two more hours in the restaurant where we were, and then he took me home, and we talked for two more hours, and then he went to say goodnight, and he went to kiss me goodnight, and I turned my cheek to him, thinking that we were saying goodbye, and he kissed me on the mouth, and he pushed me away, and he said, "You are really wonderful, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "And you know it." And I said, "Yes, I do." And he started kissing me for real. And we then didn't see each other for 3 weeks because I had to take a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we emailed and talked on the phone during those 3 weeks.
So
when I
came
back,
you actually had time to kind of sit and integrate this information then.
Yes.
That trip probably was beneficial.
Yes, it seemed to be. And then when I came back, we still met and talked a few times before we actually were intimate. Because there's a lot of things to negotiate if you're going to have protected sex.
We'll talk about what those things were. I mean, you just said we talked more before we were intimate. In other words, you've already told the end of the story that he was able to get through this.
Oh, yeah.
What was, in other words, he valued who you were. And I assume that a lot of those conversations were educating him about HIV and AIDS and a lot of other stuff, and maybe he was seeking information on his own. What were some of the things that he was asking? What were some of the things you were talking about?
About the way it's how someone gets it from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
The risk factors and what you do. A lot of it was very funny also, because you don't talk cognitively like that about specifically what you do. But, you know, you get a couple of books, and
mm-hmm.
I talk with my doctor, and I think he spoke with his.
You also called me.
I called you. Okay.
And I think you asked me for some condoms.
That's right. You gave me some condoms.
I gave you your condoms. Okay.
Well, let me tell you how wonderful he is. He, we used one of your condoms, Stuart. And then the next time I saw him, and we got into bed and he started cracking up, he had gone to a sex shop and had gotten 5 of every type of condom that they sold. And he had tried them all out. And we used the one that he liked the best. Which, I mean, it was really very sweet and very funny.
Definitely.
But, I mean, you know, it was very nice. It was very funny. And let me tell you this. If you can talk about this with somebody, it gave him license to talk about a lot of different things in his life. I mean, everybody has parts of their life that didn't work out the way they expected. You know, people, you get old enough and your spouses die and your spouses get sick and your spouses may withdraw sexually from you and, you know, and you have trouble with your children and life is never just a straight path. And when you begin a relationship the way we did, by having to face up to having protected sex with each other, having to tell the truth faster, you can tell just about any truth.
Mm-hmm.
And no truth is going to be much worse than what we've had to talk about. And it's really been very nice. It has not been a problem. It really has not. There'll be other problems in the relationship, but they won't be about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be because we don't know how to talk about difficult subjects. You know what I mean?
And the intimacy is satisfying and fulfilling for both of you?
Oh, yeah.
And here you are, 68, and how old is he?
Well, I'm 67.
67. And
he is 71.
71. So I want everybody listening to hear that you're excited, you're sexual, you're connected to somebody who's feeling the same way and able to talk about these things. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's a tool and technique I use with a lot of couples and even individuals that come into therapy when they're so afraid to say something or they think that what they have to say is going to be so difficult, I usually have them tell me what is the one thing that you're most afraid to tell me as we get started with therapy. And
mm-hmm.
I said, let's get to the most difficult thing first because after that, everything else would be a breeze.
Mm-hmm.
And it works every time, just like you're saying. Once you get to this bottom line fear, everything else is a lot easier to negotiate and discuss.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I find also that it gets to be very funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're no different than any other couple. And having to face up to these really hard things, you find humor in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't imagine you with someone who doesn't have a sense of humor to begin with, because yours is so good.
I mean, it gets to be, it's not very serious, you know. I mean, if you're committed to each other and you're having a nice time and you go to the opera and you hold hands and all your friends like one another and everything is working well, you know, what's the big deal about having trouble with a condom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a very small thing.
No pun intended. Because I hear the same conversation from a lot of my gay friends and stuff is like negotiating condom use is still, despite everything that's going on in the gay community, negotiating condom use is still difficult. Talking about it, putting it on, eroticizing it, you know, and lightening up about it because sex needs to be humor in the sexual encounter. It shouldn't all be dark and
right,
serious,
right.
You know?
You know, if you parse it down, it is sort of a silly thing to be doing.
Uh-huh. You know, it's messy, it's sweaty. It's like if you described it to someone who's never been on this planet before, they go, oh, why would anyone want to do that?
I know.
But it's what we desire because of the intimacy and the pleasure involved with it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And life is a desert without it, you know, and a picnic with it, really. Especially if you have the humor and just someone to hold you and to be with you and to share your life. And to share the bad stuff. You know, it's easy to share the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more important to share the bad stuff, I think.
And so this woman that sat in my office a few years ago saying, nobody's ever going to love me again, I'm never going to have this again, which mm-hmm. was a very real thing. I certainly never put that down or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go through that phase or that period. But what you did was empower yourself to say, okay, I have choice here. I can
mm-hmm.
believe that
mm-hmm.
and make my life worse because of it and struggle because I'm angry that I'm alone and lonely and everything else, or I can come to acceptance that right now I'm single, I might always be that way, like you said in that section that I read, or I can open up to the possibility that someone will show up and there'll be love in my life again on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, you know, that again is where you become this inspiration again, because you did not step back and dry up, you know, and stay in the closet.
I have three girlfriends now who are on eHarmony.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to a black tie event, and shortly after he and I got together, and I went to Neiman Marcus to my favorite saleswoman there, telling her I needed a gown.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her that I had fallen in love.
Mm-hmm.
She actually helped me choose my dress that I wore to my daughter's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tell her that I've met this man at eHarmony. And she's so inspired. She's now on eHarmony.
Uh-huh.
One of my very best girlfriends who recently is divorced, she's on eHarmony.
Well, you need to write this into the company and get paid for your advertising.
Yes. I have a 71-year-old woman who's a widow. She is now on eHarmony because love is contagious. I mean, people see me and they say, what's going on? You look wonderful. And I always say, I'm in love.
That's right.
I'm in love.
And people poo-poo these classified ads and these websites that are really for matching and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But eHarmony is just one of many of them, and, you know, people are meeting each other. You know?
Yes.
Now, I want to actually get to our closing here by reading one last section of this book, because to me, this kind of sums up everything we've been talking about. And you call it The Family of Man. And I quote, as the years have passed, my illness has led me to join the family of man. In doing so, I have worshipped with people and organizations who always dealt kindly with me and the AIDS epidemic. The places where we met were my churches. The sound of their protests, their tears, and their silences were my sermons. Their hope ministered to me. Their bravery inspired me. Their generosity sustained me, and their righteousness instructed me. Our mutual grief for those who died, our empathy for those who suffer pain and shame, and our compassion for those who will die of AIDS inspires us to love and respect one another. This family of man contains every age, every race, color, educational background, sexual and religious persuasion, and every socioeconomic level. This is the family to which I am proud to introduce my children and grandchildren, as we carry on dinner table discussions about what we are learning from this rare view of the world. It's a beautiful statement and philosophy, and one that I think if more people understood and adhered to, this world would be a more peaceful and better place to be living in. And again, Beverly, your journey is an incredible inspiration to all of us, and I want to thank you for being on the show again.
Oh, Stuart, thank you.
And you truly, I mean, people think the therapists are the ones doing the teaching, but I learned from so many of my clients, and you have truly been an inspiration to me.
Oh, thank you.
And one that I share, obviously without risking confidential things, to inspire other people. And you're incredible. I love you, and I want to thank you for doing this. And hopefully this time you'll be up on the archives forever.
And Stuart, thank you.
I wish you all the well, and that you're expecting a new grandchild any day now.
Yes, any moment.
So all my best to your daughter and your new grandchild and yourself.
Thank you so much, Stuart.
And I want to thank everybody for listening. And if you want to get in touch with Beverly or me about the show or anything else, you can do that through tellthetruthfaster.com. We'll be back next week with another show, another topic, another guest. And thank you for listening in. This is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM in Phoenix. Have a great weekend.